You're listening to the Carnegie Tsinghua China in the World podcast, a series of conversations with Chinese and international experts on China's foreign policy, international role, and China's relations with the world, brought to you from the Carnegie Tsinghua Center for Global Policy in Beijing. I'm Paul Hanley, the director of the Carnegie Tsinghua Center, and I'll be your host today. I'm delighted to be joined by my friend Dr. Xie Tao, a full professor of political science at Beijing Foreign Studies University, where we are conducting the interview today. On the beautiful campus here at Beiwai, as they call it in China, in Chinese. Dr. Xie Tao has a PhD from Northwestern University, and he is an expert in U.S.-China relations. Xie Tao, we're thrilled you're here with us today to discuss Obama's recent trip to Asia, tensions over the territorial disputes in South China Sea, and China's foreign policy under the new leadership. Thank you for joining us.
Well, my pleasure.
Let's begin, if we can, by examining China's foreign policy under the new leadership here in China more broadly. At this year's meeting of the National People's Congress in March, Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi characterized China's diplomacy in the first year of this leadership in office by highlighting the country's more active role as a major responsible country. Foreign Minister Wang Yi said that in 2014, China would take an active part in international and regional affairs and play a bigger role in solving global and regional issues by offering China's own solutions. I'd like to know from you, on which global and regional issues do you expect to see China playing a more active role in the coming year? And what kind of solutions do you think Chinese leaders will be interested in putting forward in this regard?
Well, this is an excellent question. Actually, I did not catch this very important statement from our minister, Wang Yi. Active part in international and regional affairs, a bigger role in solving global and regional issues, and China's own solutions. Let me start first with the China's own solutions. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, we say China socialism with Chinese characteristics. And so come to international relations, you can also say solutions with Chinese characteristics.
Right.
Now I'm thinking, like, what kind of solutions would be called Chinese solutions?
Mm-hmm.
I would say anything that fits into China's traditional foreign policy principle, for example, bilateral instead of multilateral. I would say that that would be kind of China's own, you know, solution. Second, no strings attached to foreign aid policy. I think that would be characterized as Chinese solutions.
Mm.
Another thing that comes to my mind is that, you know, on issues like Syria and others, China would not use its own veto, but China would adamantly, at least rhetorically, insist on diplomatic negotiations and non-violent solution to any of these crises.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what comes to my mind about you know, Chinese solution. And then back to the question about on global and regional issue, China may play a more active role. Well, it's very hard to think about the global and regional issues. Take the South China Sea as an example. You know, that's an regional issue, right?
Mm-hmm.
But China is definitely playing a more active. But in many people's eyes, this kind of is a negatively active. It's not positively active.
Mm-hmm.
Global issue, nuclear denuclearization, climate change, Middle East. As far as I can tell, I think it is very likely that China in this year, in particular, will play a more active role in climate change because of China's own pollution problems.
Sure.
So I think, you know, China may work, may be more willing to work with the United States on climate change.
On your earlier point about China, you may see more active diplomacy from China. Certainly we saw in the case of Syria, Ukraine, China calling for political solution.
Yes.
Which I think all countries would agree to.
Yeah.
Will we see China actually, leaders actually playing a more active diplomatic role? That is to say, on the ground, expending political capital, working with the other leaders to actually try to find solutions. Is that the kind of more active diplomacy that Foreign Wang Yi is talking about?
You know, I would just say it's possible, but it's unlikely. Why? Because if you see Chinese leaders on the ground in Crimea or let's say in Vienna, you know, in meetings with President Barack Obama or European Union leaders, you know, talking about the destiny or political future of another sovereign country, I think that goes fundamentally against China's non-interference policy, even though we know that China is actually very subtly revising and readjusting that kind of policy. Mm. But I think, you know, China wants to do something, but this is going to be very subtle.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
On that point, you mentioned China's long-standing principle of non-intervention.
Mm-hmm.
Do not interfere in the internal affairs of other countries. You mentioned that that is slightly changing.
Mm-hmm.
Can you give us a sense of how and what can we expect in the future?
Well, one example is on the Crimea issue. Even though China says, like, you know, we would respect, you know, Ukraine's sovereignty, we would also respect, like, you know, we understand that there are complex historical and the political factors behind the Crimea crisis, right? The coded language is that, you know, what happens in the eastern side of Crimea, China is actually going to give this implicit consent to the referendum there. And that is viewed by some people as a signal from the Chinese government side that, you know, China is actually willing to go along with some of the outcomes of international crises. Mm-hmm. I want to say one thing about this active diplomacy.
Yeah.
Two examples, actually. The best example is Premier Li Keqiang now is in Africa.
Mm-hmm.
Our President Xi Jinping was in European Union, the four European countries, in April, right, in late March. So I think if you are really looking for active, I would interpret this as more confident, more kind of a leadership-centered diplomacy. And the focus, you can tell, is traditionally European Union and Africa. And you do not see United States of America or Latin America.
Xiaotao, Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi also summed up the diplomatic strategy of the new leadership by focusing on three main developments. One, a new model of great power relations. A new neighborhood diplomacy featuring amity and mutual benefit. And a more balanced approach to relations with developing nations. As for the new type of great power relations between the U.S. and China, which of course was raised by Xi Jinping when he traveled to the U.S. as vice president, and again at the summit with President Obama when he was president at Sunnylands, in this context, what progress do you think has been made on defining this new concept of a new type of great power relationship? And how do you assess this effort 1 year after it was proposed at Sunnylands? How has it developed in your view?
Well, in terms of defining the concept, I think there's more struggle on the Chinese side than on the American side about what exactly is meant by this new model of great power relationship. Because the Chinese first proposed this idea, and so it's incumbent upon the Chinese leaders and scholars to tell Americans, you know, what do you mean by this?
Mm-hmm.
I think so far our focus has been, I think, two things. No confrontation and cooperation, right? No confrontation, like the former Soviet Union time, and also mutual benefit, cooperation. That's our definition. But is this new? I think it's not new.
Right.
Yeah. But what is new, I think, you know, if you compare China-U.S. relationship today with U.S., the former Soviet Union relationship, what is really different is the, you know, mind-boggling economic ties, educational, cultural exchanges between the two countries.
Right.
And these ties were almost completely missing back in the 1960s and 1970s.
Right.
I think that's the defining characteristic of this relationship.
Mm-hmm.
Now, about the efforts, you know, what has been done, I think the Chinese leadership and Chinese scholars really want to get American policymakers and officials to accept this idea. But my own sense is that there's much, much cooler reception to this idea on the American side than on the Chinese side.
And you just, of course, came back from a trip to the U.S.,
yeah.
So you probably heard some of these views expressed while you were in America.
I think, you know, in the State Department or in the Pentagon, where we met some government officials, I think their overall tone is positive about a new type of great power relationship.
Mm-hmm.
But if you examine carefully what they said, it's more or less the same thing. Economic cooperation, we will try to expand our cooperation, we will try to cooperate where we can, but we also should openly discuss our disagreements, like like the conversation between Secretary Hagel and his Chinese counterpart, you know, they can open and disagree.
Yeah,
I think that's more or less the same. I can tell, like, in the overall, the tone is positive.
Yeah.
I think Americans are receptive to this idea, but I don't believe that they are willing to fully embrace this concept.
Yeah.
So that's why, you know, Susan Rice, she said at the speech, said we need to operationalize,
yes,
quote. You know, in social science, when you say operationalize, that means you have to give me concrete indicators,
mm-hmm,
right? If you say that this relationship is healthy, tell me, what do you mean by healthy?
Yes, yes.
Right.
I think it's very astute of you to pick on that, pick up on that, the word that she used. I think it is very important to understanding the U.S. view on this. I agree with you that the U.S. is looking for some results in terms of greater cooperation.
Yeah.
And if the two sides can, as Susan Rice says, operationalize this new type of relationship, that is to say, find ways to begin working together on issues where the U.S. and China have a common stake,
mm-hmm,
where we can make progress for the betterment of both of our countries, this, I think, U.S. policymakers would be interested in. But having a new bumper sticker or a new definition just for the sake of a new definition for the relationship, I think the U.S. side, as you say, is very cool to that idea.
Right. You know, think about the slogans from the former President Bill Clinton's term, right? He said, in a comprehensive strategic partnership. You know, you can use these kind of different labels you like, but in the end, when people look at your political legacy or policy, is that tell me exactly what you did.
Right.
Or what do you propose to do?
Yes.
Right.
I think now, how do you respond? I know in the United States there is a very strong view, a very strong concern, that this concept of new type of great power relationship ultimately at the end of the day means two things. One, China wants greater respect. And two, China wants the United States to concede to its core interests. And many Americans say, if that's the starting point for this new type of great power relationship, well, it won't work. Is that the view in China, that this is something as a starting point, that the United States would have to concede on China's core interest in order to be able to move forward?
Well, I would definitely go along with the first view, that China would expect more respect from the United States. Because when you say, when you call this relationship great power relationship, that means China now is a member of the great power club.
Right.
And it deserves respect. The second thing, like, you know, China would expect the United States to concede to China on core interest. I think that that may be a little bit stretched. I think the leadership, they may not have this kind of expectation. Because first, China needs to tell Americans up front, what are my core interests, inviolable core interests? I think everybody knows it's Taiwan, but is South China Sea also a core interest? Is Diaoyu Island also a core interest? Tibet, Xinjiang, okay? This is the first thing. Second, even if you are on the same par as the United States of America, but that does not necessarily mean that you two countries do not have disputes. And once you have disputes, it's not inevitable that one side will concede to the other side.
Right.
Yeah, so that's my take on this.
Right.
But the first one, I think, you know, definitely, we do expect more respect from Americans.
Thank you very much for joining
me. My pleasure,
me
you know,
podcast.
Always.
And we look forward to having you at the center on Friday when we host a group of Harvard Kennedy School graduate students.
Yes, I'm getting very excited about that.
And we appreciate your involvement in the center. That's it for this edition of the Carnegie Tsinghua Podcast. If you'd like to read or learn more about U.S.-China relations and the security challenges in the Asia-Pacific, you can find more articles, events, and podcasts on our website at www.carnegietsinghua.org. I encourage you to visit and see the work of all our scholars at the Carnegie Tsinghua Center. Thank you for listening, and be sure to tune in next time.